Welcome to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney, from Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, whose sovereignty was never ceded. And we're broadcast right across the country on the Community Radio Network, as well as directly to your device across the globe. My name is Shane Anderson, filling in for Peter Frey. Coming up on this edition, secrecy, lies and cover-ups. Since 9/11, democratic nations have experienced a sharp rise in national security laws. But you might be surprised to find that it's actually us, Australia, who has experienced the strongest uptake in laws aimed to protect its citizens from the threat of terrorism. These laws have had a palpable effect on journalism here. Between high-tech surveillance, whistleblower laws, and an eerily incestuous relationship between media and politics, it doesn't leave much room for journalists to, you know, do journalism. How can you hold power to account when it's hiding behind laws that could put journalists in jail? Johan Lidberg is the co-editor of a new book exploring how national security laws have crippled investigative journalism in Australia. It's called In the Name of Security, Secrecy, Surveillance and Journalism. He's also Associate Professor of Journalism at Monash University, and he joins us now over Skype. I'll jump straight into it. Johan, are national security laws in Australia turning journalists into criminals?
I think there is a very distinct potential for that. There are a number of us that have made multiple submissions to the Australian federal government, because this is a federal issue predominantly, when the state have passed since 2001, September 11, 2001, the Australian Federal Parliament has passed more than 60 laws, amended or passed new ones on national security and anti-terrorism. And a number of those in their bill format were far overreaching in terms of what they really needed to do. And a number of provisions, at least on the draft stage, the bill stage, were quite threatening towards journalistic practice, and there were major issues. There was toned down somewhat, but there are certainly still major issues in the acts that we have.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about the values of journalism being pit against this idea of national security, but what does national security actually mean when you start to unpack it?
Well, that is one of the problems that we discuss in several places in the book. So national security is a very broad term, and that's part of the problem, of course. So if you have a state or a government that is secretive in nature, you can shoehorn a lot of stuff into that term, national security. So that happens somewhat in Australia, but certainly in the book we saw that there was a major problem from an international perspective, where governments tend to use that blanket term quite broadly.
Yeah, you mentioned that Australia has passed 60 laws around national security since 2001. How does that compare internationally? Is Australia worse than other countries?
We are world champions in a very dubious sport, I would say. This is talking about liberal democracies, I should add here. We have not looked at more totalitarian regimes, so there might be others there, but in the liberal democratic family of nations, Australia are world leaders in passing such laws.
How do you think this has impacted journalists in Australia's ability to do journalism?
Well, it's been a pretty severe impact, and we've seen it in a number of ways. So one way is that it's always been hard to report on national security and anti-terrorism. And don't get me wrong here. I mean, we all want to be safe and secure. So, you know, it is a very important role for governments and the state is to make sure that citizens are safe and secure. So there's this balancing act between that. But then also we want to know as citizens, and all of us, I want to know what is being done in my name. So it's become much harder for Australian journalists to access information regarding national security and anti-terrorism. That's one area. It's always been hard, but it's become even harder. A second area which is very problematic is the protection of whistleblowers. So pretty much from an Australian perspective, the only way that you can get real quality, raw information from national security agencies is via whistleblowers. And even if you have confidential sources, it's become harder and harder to protect those due to the new mass surveillance technology that has emerged in the last decade or so. So that's the second area. And then we have the third area where quite a few of the current, both amended and new acts in Australia make it a crime to even mention a security operation. And here that's understandable because an ongoing one, of course, could be problematic to name, but even to report on them afterwards can actually be criminal. So those are the three areas that are the main issues.
Yeah, let's go back to this kind of mass surveillance society. I mean, can we as journalists, can we truly assure a source that they're anonymous?
I think it's incredibly hard these days, to be honest, you know. And it should be pointed out here, of course, that we are dealing with probably the hardest reporting area of all. So we just had a panel discussion as part of our graduate media festival at Monash University where two of the panel members were Nick McKenzie and Louise Milligan, you know, both really, really well established and probably two of the leading investigative reporters in Australia today. And especially Nick McKenzie at The Age, he has over decades now used a lot of confidential sources, both in his coverage of national security issues, but also organized crime. And he sort of said, you have to be a bit careful so you don't become a bit paranoid. But by the same token, it is very hard today. It's always been problematic, but the convenience of, you know, online technologies and communication tools can be treacherous as well. So it's pretty hard if you grant confidentiality to a source that it's not done lightly, of course. Then how do you, one, communicate with this person? Yes, you can use encrypted messaging apps on your phone, which are pretty good. You can use encrypted email for sure. But all these, if someone really, really wants to actually get to the source, everything that goes and is being used online can be accessed and hacked into. And then you have the third added one where we used to be able to meet people face to face, you know, in private. That's very hard these days because of the CCTV cameras that are everywhere. And if you couple that with facial recognition software, it becomes virtually impossible. You can go out into an open field and meet, but then of course, if you're being, you know, followed by someone or surveilled by someone, we have drones. So it's very hard.
Yeah, that sounds very Cold War almost. I mean, how do you avoid being paranoid about that?
I think you need to make a pretty frank assessment of the project that you're working on. You know, who are you dealing with here? And I did discuss this with Nick McKenzie at length, actually, when he's been doing quite a few stories and investigations into organized crime in Melbourne. And that is probably the one of the trickier ones. So he sort of takes a frank assessment at the beginning of each project and tries to assess the risk. So it's about risk assessment. You know, how likely is it that someone would actually follow you, surveil you, possibly come after you? And he sort of bases it on that. But he uses online tools a lot, but with heavy encryption, of course. So using Tor operating software is an important one. Using the Signal app, for instance, on your mobile phone, which has got very, very good encryption on it. So that's the sort of stuff you need to think about.
Where do we draw this line as well between being paranoid about all the kind of possibilities of surveillance technology between like journalists actually being under surveillance? Like, do we know how common it is for journalists to be tracked?
No, we don't. and that's part of the problem. So if you look at, we have a chapter in the book that charts this historically, the second chapter, which is really, really interesting because this is nothing new, of course. You know, states and governments have been keeping tabs on journalists for a long, long time, for decades. In Australia, for instance, in that particular chapter, because some of the archival material is now available, it sort of charts how the pre-runner to the Australian Secret Intelligence Organisation was surveilling, you know, journalists and during the Second World War, even during the First World War, and so on. So we know it historically. However, today it's really hard to know to what extent that journalists are being, you know, kept tabs on. Until the Edward Snowden revelations, we knew that the new online tools and so on had great potential for mass surveillance, but not to the extent did we know that it was so common and so drastically huge. So Snowden did us a great favor. But because of the nature of intelligence and national security and surveillance, it only pops up every now and then. You know, there are court warrant and order restrictions on how intelligence agencies can use it to access, for instance, metadata from journalists. We had that one example with Paul Farrell, who is now with ABC, but he used to be with Guardian Australia, how his phone metadata was accessed, I think, by the Australian Federal Police a few years ago. But, you know, it's impossible to say how common it is, actually.
Do you think this paranoia alone can have an impact on what people are more likely to report on?
Yeah, I think so. So I think there's been a distinct chilling effect from just the fact that you have those tools and those possibilities. I'm sure that is the case. There's actually a really good probably survey and interview study to be done there. But if you look at, so that connects back to, you know, if the current Australian laws and acts in national security are turning journalists into criminals, it sort of connects back to that, because not only are there some provisions there, but the sort of weight of those new laws and amendments make it really hard to know what you can and can't do. And yes, we do have, you know, sometimes we have legal assistance and stories are legal and so on. But on an everyday basis, you can sort of almost feel the weight of the law bearing down on journalists working in these fields.
I'd like to talk a little bit about, I guess, the rhetoric of national security. So in your book, you make the connection between national security and the idea of terrorism. But when you look at the stats, Australia has really extreme security laws in comparison to, I guess, relatively few terrorist incidents.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you look at the number of terrorism cases that have gone to court, they are quite low. There are a number of plots that have been foiled that should be acknowledged. But the question is, and this is the balance, you know, how much power does the state actually need to keep us safe? And it would seem to me that there is an overreach. And that's the point that we make in the book, too. That's when we talk about this notion of a state of exception. You know, we would call it a state of emergency, but this is based on this really interesting Italian political philosopher called Giorgio Agamben, who in 2005, I think it was, published the book State of Exception, where he traces this notion back all the way back to Roman times, actually. And he gives many examples of how states historically have used the external threats for domestic purposes to sort of, you know, give themselves more far-reaching powers. And the point that we make is that in times of perceived higher threat levels, if you then increase the state powers, it is absolutely vital that when these threat levels sort of become lower again, you need to wind back those state powers. What we have seen nothing of that in Australia. We've seen one review, but our argument then is that if we keep these high levels of anti-terrorism and national security powers, once it flares up again, as it probably will, you start from a higher level, so you just increase it more and more and more, you know.
Yeah, I wonder how that plays into the fact that, I guess, the biggest perceived threat to Australian borders of the past couple of years has been asylum seekers.
Yeah, that's a really weird one. I never understand that one. I know, and to me, that's political dog whistling. You know, how can these people that come from desperate circumstances that are risking not only their own lives but their young kids' lives, you know, to run away from something that is making their lives miserable or might even kill them, how can they be a threat? This whole notion of potential, you know, terrorists that mean us harm, the sort of notion that they would hide and go undetected within those groups of asylum seekers, I just find that an incredibly far-fetched thought.
I believe that was disproved as well by a parliamentary committee not that long ago.
Yeah, and unfortunately we have a number of politicians currently who are using this over and over again as a sort of a dog whistling thing, And it's an international embarrassment. And we've been told time and again that we should stop this practice, you know. And it's frankly, again, it's being done in the name of us citizens. And I find it deeply disturbing and deeply embarrassing.
Yeah, and in the name of national security as well. What are some of the ways that journalists have been restricted in reporting on things like offshore detention?
Well, the clearest one is that Nauru have pretty much made it impossible for independent journalists to get onto the island, you know, either by refusing them visas or by making visas so expensive. From memory, they were charging $8,000 for a visa, for a media visa that you need to have. So that's the most concrete way that they've done it, I suppose. And also made it, as you were pointing to before, they've made it very hard for people, staff that have been working on Nauru, for instance, to speak up.
And you've got things like the Border Force Act, where the government can jail people who speak out against the regime.
Yeah, and they have that power, but it hasn't been used yet. And I don't think it will, actually, because it's really, really poor government PR. If you sort of think back to the 1990s, there were a number of Australian journalists who spent short amounts of time in jail. I think the longest was a few weeks for refusing to give up their naming their sources in court. And that was horrible, you know, government PR as well. They reported on really high public interest issues, and then you lock up the messenger. It did look horrible, and actually that's what started the move towards us getting shield laws.
What are the shield laws?
So they are amendments to what's called the Evidence Acts in all jurisdictions but three currently in Australia. So they make a provision for the presiding judge or magistrate who hears the case to allow the journalist to not name a source. There's been three cases so far, and two of them, the shield laws have been allowed and used and actually protected the journalist from naming their source. We don't know, however, how effective they will be, but it's certainly a step in the right direction.
What do you think the fear is on behalf of the government? Why would you go to such lengths? I mean, not just talking about offshore detention, but the whole national security regime in general.
Well, to me, there is a very strong connection to Australia's sort of heritage with the UK, where in the UK there's been an act called the Official Secrets Act since the beginning of the 1900s. And pretty much that act says that if you're a public servant, if you become employed as a public servant, you are then not allowed to disclose any information without having permission from your superiors. So that's a separate act in the UK, and we don't have a similar act, but the spirit of that act sort of permeates our criminal code, for instance. So in all criminal codes around Australia, in all jurisdictions, there are similar provisions that in effect does the same as the Official Secrets Act does in the UK. So it's this notion of not wanting to be open when you govern that we have, you know, tried to change for decades in Australia now. We've sort of made some inroads, but it's still there. And it's this notion of government is best done when governments are left alone. That's the base premise, I think.
That doesn't sound very democratic.
No, it isn't. And it takes a long, long time to change this. And if you look from an international perspective, it's actually Australia and UK, as we find in the book too, they are the outliers by far. You know, even within the old international Commonwealth, like, you know, Canada, the US and New Zealand, they have less of this sort of secrecy thing, much less actually. So for some reason, the UK and Australia have sort of stayed in this. And as I said, some changes have been made, but there's still a long way to go.
And do you think these kind of laws have enough of an impact to silence opposition or silence journalism?
Well, if you take the example of public servants, for instance, so in the federal criminal code that I know best, there's a section 70 in there that states that if a public servant reveals any information or shares any information with someone outside their department or outside government, they are then liable for up to 2 years in jail, you know. And this is any information, all the way from how many paper clips you have in your desk all the way to national security matters, which is a ridiculously, you know, wide scope. So that's a concrete way that journalists are limited in who they can actually talk to and get information from. That's why we have this whole notion of and madness of, you know, everything going via the media department these days, because most of the public servants aren't actually allowed to talk, you know. So that's a concrete example.
You did mention before as well, one of the biggest kind of threats to journalism is cracking down on whistleblowers. Yeah. Can you talk me through what's the threat of whistleblowers?
Well, I mean, it depends on what area they come from. So if they're from the public service, you have those criminal provisions. So if you have a confidential whistleblower whose name is eventually found out and revealed, they can lose their job, they can go to jail. So there's pretty severe things there. If they're from the corporate sector, you quite often have the issue of employees, as part of signing their employment contract, that there are confidentiality clauses in there. And of course, if they become a journalistic source and they give you controversial information about the company, they're in breach of this clause. And again, they could lose their job and go to jail. And then again, as I said before, if you're dealing with whistleblowers within the organized crime sphere, it could actually be dangerous to life. So there are lots of those. And Australia would do well to look internationally in terms of best practice whistleblower protection. So there are a number of those around where the whole onus is turned around, where the onus is actually on, for instance, government departments to justify why they at all should question who a source is. In Australia, we have the opposite, unfortunately.
Yeah, how does the Australian government treat whistleblowers?
Really, 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 really poorly. So they actually pursue them actively. They go after them. If there is a suspected leak within a department, the department head, even the minister, usually the department head, will pursue them forever. One of the most prominent examples of late is, of course, Witness K, you know, the former Australian spy, I suppose, who was part of the bugging operation of the Timor-Leste embassy in the lead up to the Australia-Timor-Gap oil and gas treaty, where he was part of kitting out that house with bugging devices to give the Australian government an advantage in the lead up to those negotiations, which is a pretty disgusting thing to do. You have here a really, really poor neighbour that you've helped become independent, and then you spy on them so you can get a better deal when it comes to oil and gas. And this Witness K was so disgusted by this that he blew the whistle and spoke to a number of journalists about this, and they are pursuing him full tilt.
Yeah, Witness K is such a great example, because it's a really shocking and ethically dubious story, but I feel like the media response to it here was fairly muted.
Yeah, which is a bit disappointing, I must say. There's a real something to really be pursued here. Bernard Keane in Crikey should have a lot of credit for doggedly staying with this, and there's a few of us who do research that are sort of trying to really stay with it too. Yeah, I don't know why it was so lame, I must say, or tame, the media pursuit of this, because the story, of course, is that we behaved appallingly towards a neighbour. The story isn't that we have a former spy who was disgusted. The story should be, you know, why on earth did we behave so appallingly? And it just, I don't know why it's fallen by the side. Maybe it is because, partly could be because he has decided to not speak publicly. Maybe if he spoke publicly, it would be a bigger issue.
And you've written in your book as well about the potential ripple effects of whistleblowers. So one of the examples that is given is Andrew Wilkie. Mm. And had the media been able to fully report on the case for 2003 invasion of Iraq, which Australia was part of under the Howard government, the ripple effects of being able to properly get access to this information and see both sides of the argument, this would have had a huge impact.
Yeah, it would have. And Andrew Wilkie should really be strongly commended for probably being one of the most integrity strong people in Australia for what he did. You know, he was a a colonel and a high-ranking intelligence official who he realised that there's no way that I can keep my job here. So he resigned first before he blew the whistle, because he knew that, you know, that was the end of his intelligence career, essentially. He did expose the weak case, really, clearly, I think. Again, the media wasn't really willing to report fully on this, I think. And here I must say that the Murdoch media carry most of the blame for that, I must say. They were as one across the globe in terms of the case for Iraq being just and right. And we know now, of course, that there was no such case, you know. But having said that, other parts of Australian media, unfortunately, did not step up quite the way they should have either. So, yeah, that's an example of where you wish that there would have been more transparency, and perhaps then that completely useless war could have been avoided.
It's almost like you're describing then not just, I guess, government secrecy versus investigative journalism, but, I mean, the idea of what journalism should be versus government secrecy versus also media empires?
Yeah. So media ownership concentration is a huge issue, of course, in Australia. Not only in Australia, it's a global issue, but Australia is particularly bad and stands out in its concentration. I've just finished a piece for the Australian Quarterly that talks about this. So, yeah, so if you have... I mean, usually, even within the big media owners, there would be a bit of diversity. In the case of the lead up to the 2003 Iraqi war, that was not the case. You know, most sang in tune with the government and actually were mouthpieces of the government. There was very little serious questioning about the actual case for this war. And it's hugely problematic. You sort of see then, you see that the really problematic situation you get when you have not enough media diversity.
Yeah, and if we, I guess, move forward to 2018, do you think journalism in Australia is doing a good enough job of challenging this?
I think Australian journalism is trying. There are honest attempts, I think, in pockets. What worries me most is the current attacks on the ABC, actually, and ABC and public broadcasters globally, they are the best repository that we have for carrying in-depth public interest and investigative journalism across and keep it alive for enough time for commercial media to figure out the next business plan. We're seeing some, you know, possibilities regarding that, and I'm quite optimistic that we've turned the corner. But these attacks on the ABC and the defunding, you know, in almost 25% of the total ABC budget has been cut since 2013. Of course, when Tony Abbott, in that election campaign on the election eve, famously promised no cuts to the ABC and the SBS, and more than 100 million, you know, have been cut since. So that worries me most, because I think that's not to say that there isn't good journalism done outside the ABC. I'm just pointing out the fact that it's the most obvious way to keep independent journalism going in Australia. And to add to that, it's not only an Australian matter, this, because if you look across the globe, there are only between 11 to 15 properly funded and independent public broadcasters. And that number varies a bit on what you choose to define as properly funded. But if we take the ABC as an example, you know, close to $1 billion per year, that's properly funded.
Right. So sorry, 11 to 15 public broadcasters around out of every country in the world, not just democracies.
Yes.
Wow.
That are properly funded and independent. You have a high number of public broadcasters, but a lot of them are, of course, you know, what we call state broadcasters. So they're just propaganda tools, really. So that means that if the ABC is diminished and cut back further and further and further, it's not only a diminishment of Australian independent journalism, it actually has a global impact. So we have a lot of responsibility there.
Yeah. So what is the way forward then? Can journalism in Australia meet the challenge?
Well, there are a number of things to consider. I think another review would be timely, to look to assess the powers that the Australian national security apparatus have got. You know, are they at the right level? Is the both real and perceived, you know, terrorism threat, is that lower now? So, and if so, does that mean that we then need to somehow roll back a bit of those powers? Certainly when it comes to transparency and ability to access information on this sort of stuff, So Australia stands out as well in terms of freedom of information laws and the fact that all Australian national security agencies are completely exempt from FOI. That's not the case in the US, for instance. In the US, you can use FOI to get information from the CIA. It's not easy, but you know, sends an important message. So I would suggest that FOI should apply to all government agencies, every single one. That's another concrete one. And a third one that I think needs to be considered as well is, of course, whistleblower protection. So there needs to be, you know, a lot of thinking around how they can be protected and seen as an asset and a good thing rather than bad guys. We need to think carefully about that. We do mention in the book the Tashwana principles, which was a really quite remarkable agreement between 70 countries, or it was an agreement on guidelines for how to balance security and openness. And I think those principles, there are 40 of them, Australia could do really well from having a long, hard look at them.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Johan, for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
That was Johan Lidberg, Associate Professor of Journalism at Monash University. And he's also co-editor of the book In the Name of Security. That's it for this episode, so make sure you subscribe so you can hear more independent analysis of journalists and journalism. We'll be back soon, so stay in touch on Facebook or Twitter. The handle is @ 4th Estate AU. My name is Shane Anderson. Thank you for listening.